This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Chapter 28 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 28. It was close on dressing time when Charles came into the drawing room, where Evelyn and Molly were building castles on the hearthrug in the ruddy firelight. After changing his damp clothes, he had gone to the smoking room, but he had found Dare sitting there in a vast dressing gown of Ralph's, in a state of such utter dejection, with his head in his hands, that he had silently retreated again before he had been perceived. He did not want to see Dare just now. He wished he were not in the house. Quite oblivious of the fact that he was not in Evelyn's good graces, he went and sat by the drawing-room fire, and absently watched Molly playing with her bricks. Presently, when the dressing-bell rang, Evelyn went away to dress, and Molly, tired of her castles, suggested that she might sit on his knee. He let her climb up and wriggle and finally settle herself, as it seemed good to her, but he did not speak, and so they sat in the firelight together, Molly's hand lovingly stroking his black velvet coat. But her talents lay in conversation, not in silence, and she soon broke it. "You do look beautiful tonight, Uncle Charles."
"Do I?" without elation.
"Do you know, Uncle Charles, Ninny's sister with the wart on her cheek has been to tea? She's in the nursery now. Ninny says she's to have a bite of supper before she goes."
"You don't say so."
"And we had buttered toast to tea, and she said you were the most splendid gentleman she ever saw."
Charles did not answer. He did not even seem to have heard this interesting tribute to his personal appearance. Molly felt that something must be gravely amiss, and laying her soft cheek against his, she whispered confidentially,
"Uncle Charles, are you uncomfortable inside?"
There was a long pause.
"Yes, Molly," at last, pressing her to him.
"Is it there?"
said Molly sympathetically, laying her hand on the front portion of her amber sash.
"No, Molly, I only wish it were."
"It's not the little green pears, then," said Molly, with a sigh of experience, "because it's always just there, always with them. It was again yesterday. They're nasty little pears," with a touch of personal resentment.
Uncle Charles smiled at last, but it was not quite his usual smile.
"Miss Molly," said a voice from the door, "your mamma has sent for you." "It's not bedtime yet."
"Your mamma says you are to come at once," was the reply.
Molly, knowing from experience that an appeal to Charles was useless on these occasions, wriggled down from her perch rather reluctantly and bade her uncle good night. "Perhaps it will be better tomorrow," she said consolingly.
"Perhaps," he said, nodding at her, and he took her little head between his hands and kissed her. She rubbed his kiss off again and walked gravely away. She could not be merry and ride in triumph upstairs on kind, curvetting Sarah's willing back while her friend was uncomfortable inside. There was no galloping down the passage that night, no pleasantries with the sponge in Molly's tub, no last caperings in light attire. Molly went silently to bed, and as on a previous occasion, when in great anxiety about the Vic, who had thoughtlessly gone out in the twilight for a stroll and had forgotten the lapse of time, she added a whispered clause to her little petitions which the ear of Ninny failed to catch. Charles recognised, in the way Evelyn had taken Molly from him, that she was not yet appeased. It should be remembered, in order to do her justice, that a good woman's means of showing a proper resentment are so straitened and circumscribed by her conscience that she is obliged, from actual want of material, to resort occasionally to little acts of domestic tyranny, small in themselves, as midge-bites, but fortunately, for the cause of virtue, equally exasperating. Indeed, it is improbable that any really good woman would ever so far forget herself as to lose her temper, if she were once thoroughly aware how much more irritating in the long run a judicious course of those small persecutions may be made, which the tenderest conscience need not scruple to inflict. Charles was unreasonably annoyed at having Molly taken from him. As he sat by the fire alone, tired in mind and body, a hovering sense of cold and an intense weariness of life took him, and a great longing came over him like a thirst, a longing for a little of the personal happiness which seemed to be the common lot of so many around him, for a home where he had now only a house, for love and warmth and companionship, and possibly some day a little Molly of his own, who would not be taken from him at the caprice of another. The only barrier to the fulfilment of such a dream had been a conscientious scruple of Ruth's, to which at the time he had urged upon her that she did wrong to yield. That barrier was now broken down, but it ought never to have existed. Ruth and he belonged to each other by divine law, and she had no right to give herself to anyone else to satisfy her own conscience. And now all would be well. She was absolved from her promise. She had been wrong to persist in keeping it, in his opinion, but at any rate she was honourably released from it now, and she would marry him. And that second promise which he had made to Dare, that she would still marry him if he were free to marry? Charles moved impatiently in his chair. From what exaggerated sense of duty she had made that promise, he knew not, but he would save her from the effects of her own perverted judgment. He knew what Ruth's word meant, since he had tried to make her break it. He knew that she had promised to marry Dare if he were free. He knew that, having made that promise, she would keep it. It would be mere sentimental folly on his part to say the word that would set Dare free. Even if the American woman were not his wife in the eye of the law, she had a moral claim upon him. The possibility of Ruth still marrying Dare was too hideous to be thought of. If her judgment was so entirely perverted by a morbid, conscientious fear of following her own inclination that she could actually give Dare that promise, directly after the arrival of the adventurers, Charles would take the decision out of her hands. As she could not judge fairly for herself, he would judge for her and save her from herself. For her sake, as much as for his own, he resolved to say nothing. He had only to keep silence. There's no one to tell if you don't. The door opened, and Charles gave a start as Dare came into the room. He was taken aback by the sudden rush of jealous hatred that surged up within him at his appearance. It angered and shamed him, and Dare, much shattered but feebly cordial, found him very irresponsive and silent for the few minutes that remained before the dinner bell rang and the others came down. It was not a pleasant meal. If Dare had been a shade less ill, he must have noticed the marked coldness of Evelyn's manner, and how Ralph good-naturedly endeavoured to make up for it by double helpings of soup and fish, which he was quite unable to eat. Charles and Lady Mary were never congenial spirits at the best of times, and tonight was not the best. That lady, after feebly provoking the attack, as usual, sustained some crushing defeats, mainly couched in the language of Scripture, which was, as she felt with Christian indignation, turning her own favourite weapon against herself, as possibly Charles thought she deserved, for putting such a weapon to so despicable a use. "I really don't know," she said tremulously afterwards in the drawing-room, "what Charles will come to if he goes on like this. I don't mind," venomously, "his tone towards myself. That I do not regard. But his entire want of reverence for the Church and apostolic succession, his profane remarks about vestments, in short, his entire attitude towards religion, gives me the gravest anxiety." In the dining-room the conversation flagged, and Charles was beginning to wonder whether he could make some excuse and bolt, when a servant came in with a note for him. It was from the doctor in Deep, and ran as follows. "Dear sir, I've just seen, 6:30 p.m, Stevens again. I've had him in a state of the wildest excitement, and he implored me to send you word that he wanted to see you again. He seemed so sure that you would go, if you knew he wished it, that I've commissioned Sergeant Brown's boy to take this. He wished me to say there was something more. If there is any further confession he desires to make, he has not much time to do it in. I did not expect he would have lasted till now. As it is, he's going fast. Indeed, I hardly think you will be in time to see him, but I promise to give you this message. Yours faithfully, R. White." "I must go," Charles said, throwing the note across to Ralph. "Give the boy half a crown, will you? I suppose I may take Othello?" Before Ralph had mastered the contents of the note and begun to fumble for a half-crown, Charles was saddling Othello himself without waiting for the groom, and in a few minutes was clattering over the stones out of the yard. There was just light enough to ride by, and he rode hard. What was it? What could it be that Raymond had still to tell him? He felt certain it had something to do with Ruth, and probably Dare. should he arrive in time to hear it. There at last were the lights of Deep in front of him. Should he arrive in time? As he pulled up his steaming horse before the police station, his heart misgave him. "Am I too late?" he asked the man who came to the door. He looked bewildered. "Stevens, is he dead?" The man shook his head.
"They say he's almost gone."
Charles threw the rein to him and hurried indoors. He met someone coming out, the doctor probably, he thought afterwards, who took him upstairs and sent away the old woman who was in attendance.
"I can't do anything more," he said, opening the door for him. "Wanted elsewhere. Very good of you, I'm sure. Not much use, I'm afraid. Good night. I'll tell the old woman to be about."
A dim lamp was burning on the little corner cupboard near the door, and as Charles bent over the bed, he saw in a moment, even by that pale light, that he was too late. Life was still there, if that feeble tossing could be called life, but all else was gone. Raymond's feet were already on the boundary of the land where all things are forgotten, and at the sight of that dim country, memory, affrighted, had slipped away and left him. Was it possible to recall him to himself even yet?
"Raymond," he said in a low, distinct voice, "what is it you wish to say? Tell me quickly what it is."
But the long agony of farewell between body and soul had begun, and the eyes that seemed to meet his with momentary recognition only looked at him in anguish, seeking help and finding none, and wandered away again, vainly searching for that which was not to be found. Charles could do nothing, but he had not the heart to leave him to struggle with death entirely alone. And so, in awed and helpless compassion, he sat by him through one long hour after another, waiting for the end which still delayed, his eyes wandering ever and anon from the bed to the high grated window, or idly spelling out the different names and disparaging remarks the previous occupants had scratched and scrawled over the whitewashed walls. And so the hours passed. At last, all in a moment, the struggle ceased. The dying man vainly tried to raise himself to meet what was coming, and Charles put his strong arm round him and held him up. He knew that consciousness sometimes returns at the moment of death. "Raymond," he whispered earnestly, "Raymond." A tremor passed over the face. The lips moved. The homeless, lingering soul came back and looked for the last time fixedly and searchingly at him out of the dying eyes, and then, seeing no help for it, went hurriedly on its way, leaving the lips parted to speak, leaving the deserted eyes vacant and terrible, until after a time Charles closed them. He had gone without speaking. Whatever he had wished to say would remain unsaid forever. Charles laid him down and stood a long time looking at the set face. The likeness to Raymond seemed to be fading away under the touch of the mighty hand, but the look of Ruth, the better look, remained. At last he turned away and went out, stopping to wake the old nurse, heavily asleep in the passage. His horse was brought round for him from somewhere, and he mounted and rode away. He had no idea how long he had been there. It must have been many hours, but he had quite lost sight of time. It was still dark, but the morning could not be far off. He rode mechanically, his horse, which knew the road, taking him at its own pace. The night was cold, but he did not feel it. All power of feeling anything seemed gone from him. The last 2 days and nights of suspense and high-strung emotion seemed to have left him incapable of any further sensation at present beyond that of an intense fatigue. He rode slowly and put up his horse with careful absence of mind. The eastern horizon was already growing pale and distinct as he found his way indoors through the drawing-room window, the shutter of which had been left unhinged for him by Ralph, according to custom when either of them was out late. He went noiselessly up to his room and sat down. After a time he started to find himself still sitting there, but he remained without stirring, too tired to move, his elbows on the table, his chin in his hands. He felt he could not sleep if he were to drag himself into bed. He might just as well stay where he was. And as he sat watching the dawn, his mind began to stir, to shake off its lethargy and stupor, to struggle into keener and keener consciousness. There are times, often accompanying great physical prostration, when a veil seems to be lifted from our mental vision. As in the Mediterranean, one may glance down suddenly on a calm day and see in the blue depths with a strange surprise the seaweed and the rocks and the fretted sands below. So also, in rare hours, we see the hidden depths of the soul, over which we have floated in heedless unconsciousness so long, and catch a glimpse of the hills and the valleys of those untravelled regions. Charles sat very still with his chin in his hands. His mind did not work. It looked right down to the heart of things. There is perhaps no time when mental vision is so clear, when the mind is so sane, as when death has come very near to us. There is a light which he brings with him, which he holds before the eyes of the dying, the stern light, seldom seen, of reality, before which self-deception and meanness, and that which maketh a lie, cower in their native deformity and slip away. And death sheds at times a strange gleam from that same light upon the souls of those who stand within his shadow and watch his kingdom coming. In an awful transfiguration all things stand for what they are. Evil is seen to be evil, and good to be good. Right and wrong sunder more far apart, and we cannot mistake them as we do at other times. The debatable land stretching between them, that favourite resort of undecided natures, disappears for a season, and offers no longer its false refuge. The mind is taken away from all artificial supports, and the knowledge comes home to the soul afresh, with strong conviction, that truth is our only armour in all passages of life, as with awed hearts we see it is the only armour in the hour of death, the only shield that we may bear away with us into the unknown country. Charles shuddered involuntarily. His decision of the afternoon to keep secret what Raymond had told him was gradually but surely assuming a different aspect. What was it, after all, but a suppression of truth, a kind of lie? What was it but doing evil that good might come? It was no use harping on the old string of consequences. He saw that he had resolved to commit a deliberate sin, to be false to that great principle of life, right for the sake of right, truth for the love of truth, by which of late he had been trying to live. So far it had not been difficult, for his nature was not one to do things by halves. But now, old voices out of the past, which he had thought long dead, rose out of forgotten graves to urge him on. What was he that he should stick at such a trifle? Why should a man with his past begin to split hairs? And conscience said nothing, only pointed, only showed, with a clearness that allowed of no mistake, that he had come to a place where two roads meet. Charles's heart suffered then the nature of an insurrection. The old lawless powers that had once held sway and had been forced back into servitude under the new rule of the last few years of responsibility and honour broke loose and spread like wildfire through the kingdom of his heart. The struggle deepened to a battle fierce and furious. His soul was rent with a frenzy of tumult, of victory and defeat, ever-changing sides, ever-returning to the attack. Can a kingdom divided against itself stand? He sat motionless, gazing with absent eyes in front of him. And across the shock of battle, and above the turmoil of conflicting passions, Ruth's voice came to him. He saw the pale spiritual face, the deep eyes so full of love and anguish, and yet so steadfast with a great resolve. He heard again her last words, "I cannot do what is wrong, even for you." He stretched out his hand suddenly. "You would not, Ruth," he said, half aloud. "You would not. Neither will I do what I know to be wrong for you. So help me God, not even for you." The dawn was breaking clear and cold and infinitely far away, was coming up through unfathomable depths and distances, through gleaming caverns and fastnesses of light, like a new revelation fresh from God. But Charles did not see it, for his head was down on the table, and he was crying like a child. End of chapter 28. Chapter 29 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 29. Dare was down early the following morning, much too early for the convenience of the housemaids who were dusting the drawing-room when he appeared there. He was usually as late as any of the young and gilded unemployed who felt it incumbent on themselves to show by these public demonstrations their superiority to the rules and fixed hours of the working and thinking world, with whom, however, their fear of being identified is a groundless apprehension. But today, Dare experienced a mournful satisfaction in being down so early. He felt the underlying pathos of such a marked departure from his usual habits. It was obvious that nothing but deep affliction or cub-hunting could have been the cause, and the cub-hunting was over. The inference was not one that could be missed by the meanest capacity. He took up the newspaper with a sigh, and settled himself in front of the blazing fire, which was still young and leaping, with the enthusiasm of dry sticks not quite gone out of it. Charles heard Dare go down just as he finished dressing, for he too was early that morning. There was more than half an hour before breakfast time. He considered a moment and then went downstairs. Some resolutions once made cannot be carried out too quickly. As he passed through the hall, he looked out. The mist of the night before had sought out every twig and leaflet and had silvered it to meet the sun. The rime on the grass looked cool and tempting. Charles's head ached, and he went out for a moment and stood in the crisp, still air. The rooks were cawing high up. The face of the earth had not altered during the night. It shimmered and was glad, and smiled at his grave, careworn face. "Hello," called a voice, and Ralph's head, with his hair sticking straight out on every side, was thrust out of a window. "I say, Charles, early bird you are." "Yes," said Charles, looking up and leisurely going indoors again. "You are the first worm I have seen." He found Dare, as he expected, in the drawing-room, and proceeded at once to the business he had in hand. "I'm glad you're down early," he said. "You're the very man I want." "Ah," replied Dare, shaking his head, "when the heart is troubled, there is no sleep, none. All the clocks are heard." "Possibly. I should not wonder if you heard another in the course of half an hour, which will mean breakfast. In the meantime—" "I want no breakfast. A sole cup of—" "In the meantime," continued Charles, "I have some news for you." And disregarding another interruption, he related as shortly as he could the story of Stephen's recognition of him in the doorway, and the subsequent revelations in the prison concerning Dare's marriage. "Where is this man, this Stephen's?" said Dare, jumping up. "I'll go to him. I will hear from his own mouth. Where is he?"
"I don't know," replied Charles curtly. "It is a matter of opinion. He's dead."
Dare looked bewildered, and then sank back with a gasp of disappointment into his chair. Charles, whose temper was singularly irritable this morning, repeated with suppressed annoyance the greater part of what he had just said, and proved to Dare that the fact that Stevens was dead would in no way prevent the illegality of his marriage being proved. When Dare had grasped the full significance of that fact, he was quite overcome.
"Am I then?" he gasped. "Is it true? Am I free to marry?"
"Quite free."
Dare burst into tears, and partially veiling with one hand the manly emotion that had overtaken him, he extended the other to Charles, who did not know what to do with it when he had got it, and dropped it as soon as he could. But Dare, like many people whose feelings are all on the surface, and who are rather proud of displaying them, was slow to notice what was passing in the minds of others. He sprang to his feet and began to pace rapidly up and down. "I will go after breakfast, at once, immediately after breakfast, to Slumberly Rectory."
"I suppose, in that case, Miss Daincourt is the person whose name you would not mention the other day?"
"She is," said Dare. "You are right, it is she. We are betrothed. I will fly to her after breakfast."
"You know your own affairs best," said Charles,
whose temper had not been improved by the free display of Dare's finer feelings. "But I am not sure you would not do well to fly to Vanden first. It is best to be off with the old love, I believe, before you are on with the new."
"She must at once go away from Vanden," said Dare, stopping short. "She is a scandal, the old one. But how to make her go away?"
It was in vain for Charles to repeat that Dare must turn her out. Dare had premonitory feelings that he was quite unequal to the task.
"I may tell her to go," he said, raising his eyebrows. "I may be firm as the rock, but I know her well. She is more obstinate than me. She will not go."
"She must," said Charles, with anger. "Her presence compromises Miss Daincourt. Can't you see that?"
Dare raised his eyebrows. A light seemed to break in on him.
"Any fool can see that," said Charles, losing his temper.
Dare saw a great deal, many things besides that. He saw that if a friend, a trusted friend, were to manage her dismissal, it would be more easy for that friend than for one whose feelings at the moment might carry him away. In short, Charles was the friend who was evidently pointed out by Providence for that mission. Charles considered a moment. He began to see that it would not be done without further delays and scandal, unless he did it. "She must and shall go at once, even if I have to do it," he said at last, looking at Dare with unconcealed contempt. "It is not my affair, but I will go, and you will be so good as to put off the flying over to Slumberley till I come back. I shall not return until she has left the house." And Charles marched out of the room, too indignant to trust himself a moment longer with a profusely grateful Dare. "That man must go today," said Evelyn, after breakfast, to her husband, in the presence of Lady Mary and Charles. "While he was ill, I overlooked his being in the house, but I will not suffer him to remain now he is well." "You remove him from all chance of improvement," said Charles, "if you take him away from Aunt Mary, who can snatch brands for the burning, as we all know. But I am going over to Vanden this morning, and if you wish it, I will ask him if he would like me to order his dog-cart to come for him. I don't suppose he is very happy here, without so much as a toothbrush that he can call his own." "You are going to Vanden?" asked both ladies in one voice. "Yes, I am going on purpose to dislodge an impostor who has arrived there, who is actually believed by some people, who are not such exemplary Christians as ourselves and ready to suppose the worst, to be his wife." Lady Mary and Evelyn looked at each other in consternation, and Charles went off to see how Othello was after his night's work, and to order the dog-cart, Ralph calling after him in perfect good humour that "Othello's brother got more out of Othello's horses than Othello did himself." Dare waylaid Charles on his return from the stables and linked his arm in his. He felt the most enthusiastic admiration for the tall, reserved Englishman who had done him such signal service. He longed for an opportunity of showing his gratitude to him. It was perhaps just as well that he was not aware how very differently Charles regarded himself. "You're just going?" Dare asked. "In 5 minutes." Charles let his arm hang straight down, but Dare kept it. "Tell me, my friend, one thing." Dare had evidently been turning over something in his mind. "That poor unfortunate, this Stevens, why did he not tell you all this the first time you went to see him in the afternoon?"
"He did."
"What?" said Dare, looking hard at him. "He did? And you only tell me this morning? You let me go all through the night first. Why was this?" Charles did not answer. "I ask one thing more," continued Dare. "Did you divine 2 nights ago, from what I said in a moment of confidence, that Miss Dainkort was the...
"Of course I did," said Charles sharply. "You made it sufficiently obvious."
"Ah," said Dare. "Ah." And he shut his eyes and nodded his head several times.
"Anything more you would like to know?" asked Charles, inattentive and impatient, mainly occupied in trying to hide the nameless exasperation which invariably seized him when he looked at Dare,
and to stifle the contemptuous voice which always whispered as he did so, "And you've given up Ruth to him? To him?" "No, no, no," said Dare, shaking his head gently, and regarding him the while with infinite interest through his half-closed eyelids. The dog-cart was coming round, and Charles hastily turned from him, and getting in, drove quickly away. Whatever Dare said or did seemed to set his teeth on edge, and he lashed up the horse till he was out of sight of the house. Dare, with arms picturesquely folded, stood looking after him with mixed feelings of emotion and admiration. "One sees it well," he said to himself. "One sees now the reason of many things. He kept silent at first, but he was too good, too noble. In the night he considered. In the morning he told all. I wondered that he went to Vanden, but he did it, not for me. It was for her sake." Dare's feelings were touched to the quick. How beautiful, how pathetic was this denouement! His former admiration for Charles was increased 1,000-fold. He also loved. Ah! Dare felt he was becoming agitated. How sublime, how touching was his self-sacrifice in the cause of honour! He had been gradually working himself up to the highest pitch of pleasurable excitement and emotion, and now, seeing Ralph the prosaic approaching, he fled precipitately into the house, caught up his hat and stick, hardly glancing at himself in the hall-glass, and entirely forgetting his promise to Charles to remain at Atherston till the latter returned from Vanden, followed the impulse of the moment and struck across the fields in the direction of Slumberley. Charles, meanwhile, drove on to Vanden. The stable clock, still partially paralysed from long disuse, was laboriously striking 11 as he drew up before the door. His resounding peal of the bell startled the household and put the servants into a flutter of anxious expectation, while the sound made someone else, breakfasting late in the dining-room, pause with her cup midway to her lips and listen. "There is a train which leaves Lumley Station for London a little after 12, is not there?" asked Charles with great distinctness of the butler as he entered the hall. He had observed as he came in that the dining-room door was ajar.
"There is, Sir Charles, 12:15, replied the man, who recognised him instantly, for everybody knew Charles.
"I'm here as Mr. Dare's friend, at his wish. Tell Mr. Dare's coachman to bring round his dog-cart to the door in good time to catch that train. Will it take luggage?"
"Yes, Sir Charles," with respectful alacrity.
"Good. And when the dog-cart appears, you will see that the boxes are brought down, belonging to the person who is staying here, who will leave by that train."
"Yes, Sir Charles."
"If the policeman from Slumley should arrive while I am here, ask him to wait."
"I will, Sir Charles."
I don't suppose, thought Charles, he will arrive, as I have not sent for him. But as the dining-room door happens to be ajar, it is just as well to add a few artistic touches. "Is this person in the drawing-room?" he continued aloud. The man replied that she was in the dining-room, and Charles walked in unannounced and closed the door behind him. He had at times, when any action of importance was on hand, a certain cool decision of manner that seemed absolutely to ignore the possibility of opposition, which formed a curious contrast with his usual careless demeanour. "Good morning," he said, advancing to the fire. "I have no doubt that my appearance at this early hour cannot be a surprise to you. You have, of course, anticipated some visit of the kind for the last few days. Pray finish your coffee. I am Sir Charles Danvers. I need hardly add that I am Justice of the Peace in this county, and that I am here officially on behalf of my friend, Mr. Dare." The little woman, who had risen and had then sat down again at his entrance, eyed him steadily. There was a look in her dark, bead-like eyes which showed Charles why Dare had been unable to face her. The look, determined, cunning, watchful, put him on his guard, and his manner became a shade more unconcerned. "Any friend of my husband is welcome," she said. "There's no question for the moment about your husband, though no doubt a subject of peculiar interest to yourself. I was speaking of Mr. Dare." She rose to her feet, as if unable to sit while he was standing. "Mr. Dare is my husband," she said with a little gesture of defiance, tapping sharply on the table with the teaspoon she held in her hand. Charles smiled blandly and looked out of the window. "There is evidently some misapprehension on that point," he observed, "which I am here to remove. Mr. Dare is at present unmarried." "I am his wife," reiterated the woman, her colour rising under her rouge. "I am, and I won't go. He dared not come himself, a poor coward that he is, to turn his wife out of doors. He sends you. But it's no manner of use, so you may as well know it first as last. I tell you, nothing shall induce me to stir from this house, from my home, and you needn't think you can come it over me with fine talk. I don't care a red cent what you say. I'll have my rights." "I'm here," said Charles, "to see that you get them, Mrs. Carroll." There was a pause. He did not look at her. He was occupied in taking a white thread off his coat. "Carroll's dead," she said sharply. "He is, and your regret at his loss was no doubt deepened by the unhappy circumstances in which it took place. He died in jail." "Well, and if he did?" "Died," continued Charles, suddenly fixing his keen glance upon her, "nearly a year after your so-called marriage with Mr. Dare." "It's a lie," she said faintly, but she turned very white. "No, I think not. My information is on reliable authority. A slight exertion on your part will no doubt recall the date of your bereavement."
"You can't prove it."
"Excuse me. You have yourself kindly furnished us with a copy of the marriage register, with the date attached, without which I must own we might have been momentarily at a loss. I need now only apply for a copy of the register of the decease of Jasper Carroll, who, as you do not deny, died under personal restraint in jail. In Baton Rouge jail in Louisiana, I have no doubt you intended to add." She glared at him in silence. "Some dates acquire a peculiar interest when compared," continued Charles, "but I will not detain you any longer with business details of this kind, as I have no doubt that you will wish to superintend your packing."
"I won't go."
"On the contrary, you will leave this house in half an hour.
The dogcart is ordered to take you to the station. What if I refuse to go? Extreme measures are always to be regretted, especially with a lady, said Charles. Nothing, in short, would be more repugnant to me. But I fear, as a magistrate, it would be my duty to... And he shrugged his shoulders, wondering what on earth could be done for the moment if she persisted. But, he continued, motives of self-interest suggest the advisability of withdrawing, even if I were not here to enforce it. When I take into consideration the trouble and expense you have incurred in coming here, and the subsequent disappointment of the affections, a widow's affections, I feel justified in offering, though without my friend's permission, to pay your journey back to America, an offer which any further unpleasantness or delay would of course oblige me to retract. She hesitated, and he saw his advantage and kept it. You have not much time to lose, he said, laying his watch on the table, unless you would prefer the housekeeper to do your packing for you. No, I agree with you. On a sea voyage especially, one likes to know where one's things are. If I give you a cheque for your return journey, I shall of course expect you to sign a paper to the effect that you have no claim on Mr. Dare, that you never were his legal wife, and that you will not trouble him in future. You would like a few minutes for reflection? Good. I will write out the form while you consider, as there is no time to be lost. He looked about for writing materials, and finding only an ancient inkstand and pen, took a note from his pocket-book and tore a blank half-sheet off it. His quiet, deliberate movements awed her as he intended they should. She glanced first at him writing, then at the gold watch on the table between them, the hours of which were marked on the half-hunting face by alternate diamonds and rubies, each stone being the memorial of a past success in shooting matches. The watch impressed her. To her practised eye it meant a very large sum of money, and she knew the power of money. But the cool, unconcerned manner of this tall, keen-eyed Englishman impressed her still more. As she looked at him, he ceased writing, got out a cheque, and began to fill it in. "What Christian name?" he asked suddenly. "Ellen," she replied, taken aback. "Payable to order or bearer?" "Bearer," she said, confused by the way he took her decision for granted. "Now," he said authoritatively, "sign your name there," and he pushed the form he had drawn up towards her. "I am sorry I cannot offer you a better pen." She took the pen mechanically and signed her name, Ellen Carroll. Charles's light eyes gave a flash as she did it. "Manner is everything," he said to himself. "I believe the mention of that imaginary policeman may have helped, but a little stage effect did the business." "Thank you," he said, taking the paper, and after glancing at the signature, putting it in his pocket-book. "Allow me to give you this," handing her the cheque. "And now I will ring for the housekeeper, for you will barely have time to make the arrangements for your journey. I can allow you only 20 minutes. He rang the bell as he spoke. She started up as if unaware how far she had yielded. A rush of angry colour flooded her face. "I won't have that impertinent woman touching my things." "That is as you like," said Charles, shrugging his shoulders. "But she will be in the room when you pack. It's my wish that she should be present." Then, turning to the butler, who had already answered the bell, "Desire the housekeeper to go to Mrs. Carroll's rooms at once, and to give Mrs. Carroll any help she may require." Mrs. Carroll looked from the butler to Charles with baffled hatred in her eyes. But she knew the game was lost, and she walked out of the room and upstairs without another word, but with a bitter consciousness in her heart that she had not played her cards well, that, though her downfall was unavoidable, she might have stood out for better terms for her departure. She hated Dare as she threw her clothes together into her trunks, and she hated Mrs. Smith, who watched her do so with folded hands and with a lofty smile. But most of all she hated Charles, whose voice came up to the open window as he talked to Dare's coachman, already at the door, about splints and sore backs. Charles felt a momentary pity for the little woman when she came down at last with compressed lips, casting lightning glances at the grinning servants in the background, whom she bullied and hectored over in the manner of people unaccustomed to servants, and who were rejoicing in the ignominy of her downfall. Her boxes were put in, not carefully. Charles came forward and lifted his cap, but she would not look at him. Grasping a little handbag convulsively, she went down the steps and got up, unassisted, into the dog-cart. "You have left nothing behind, I hope?" said Charles civilly, for the sake of saying something. "She's left nothing," said Mrs. Smith, swimming forward with dignity. "And she also took nothing. I've seen to that, Sir Charles." "Good-bye, then," said Charles. "Right, coachman."
Mrs. Carroll's eyes had been wandering upward to the old house rising above her with its sunniest windows and its pointed gables. Perhaps, after all the sordid shifts and schemes of her previous existence, she had imagined she might lead an easier and a more respectable life within those walls. Then she looked towards the long green terraces, the valley, and the forest beyond. Her lip trembled, and turning suddenly, she fixed her eyes with burning hatred on the man who had ousted her from this pleasant place. Then the coachman whipped up his horse, the dog-cart spun over the smooth gravel between the lines of stiff-clipped yews, and she was gone. End of chapter 29. Chapter 30 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 30. Mr. Alwyn had returned from his eventful morning call at Vanden, very grave and silent. He shook his head when Ruth came to him in the study to ask what the result had been, and said Dare would tell her himself on his return from London, whither he had gone on business. Ruth went back to the drawing-room. She had not strength or energy to try to escape from Mrs. Alwyn. Indeed, it was a relief not to be alone with her thoughts, and to allow her exhausted mind to be towed along by Mrs. Alwyn's, the bent of whose mind resembled one of those mechanical toy animals, which, when wound up, will run very fast in any direction, but if adroitly turned, will hurry equally fast the opposite way. Ruth turned the toy at intervals, and the morning was dragged through, Mrs. Alwyn, in the course of it, exploring every realm known to her of human thought, now dipping into the future and speculating on spring fashions, now commenting on the present, now dwelling fondly on the past, the gaily dressed, officer-adorned past of her youth. There was a meal, and after that it was the afternoon. Ruth supposed that sometime there would be another meal, and then it would be evening, but it was no good thinking of what was so far away. She brought her mind back to the present. Mrs. Alwyn had just finished a detailed account of a difference of opinion between herself and the curate's wife on the previous day. "And she had not a word to say, my dear, not a word, quite hors de combat, so I let the matter drop. And you remember that beautiful pig we killed last week? You should have gone to look at it hanging up, Ruth, rolling in fat it was. Well, it is better to give than to receive, so I shall send her one of the pork pies, and if you will get me one of those round baskets where I took the dolls down to the school feast in, they are in the lowest shelf of the oak chest in the hall, I'll send it down to her at once." Ruth fetched the basket and put it down by her aunt. Reminiscences of the school feast still remained in it, in the shape of ends of ribbon and lace, and Mrs. Alwyn began to empty them out, talking all the time, when she suddenly stopped short with an exclamation of surprise. "Goodness! Well, now, I'm sure, Ruth!" "What is it, Aunt Fanny?" "Why, my dear, if there isn't a letter for you under the odds and ends!" holding it up and gazing resentfully at it. "And now I remember a letter came for you on the morning of the school feast, and I said to John I shan't forward it because I shall see Ruth this afternoon. And, dear me, I just popped it into the basket, for I thought you would like to have it, and you know how busy I was, Ruth, that day. That first one thing and then another, so much to think of. There it is!" "I dare say it is of no importance," said Ruth, taking it from her, while Mrs. Alwyn, repeatedly wondering how such a thing could have happened to the person so careful as herself, went off with her basket to the cook. When she returned in a few minutes, she found Ruth standing by the window, the letter open in her hand, her face without a vestige of colour. "Why, Ruth," she said, actually noticing the alteration in her appearance, "is your head bad again?" Ruth started violently. "Yes, no, I mean, I think I will go out. The fresh air..." She could not finish the sentence. "And that tarsome letter, did it want an answer?" "None," said Ruth, crushing it up unconsciously. "Well, now," said Mrs. Alwyn, "that's a good thing, for I'm sure I shall never forget the way your uncle was in once when I put a letter of his in my pocket to give him. It was a plum-coloured silk, Ruth, done with gold beads in front, and then I went into mourning for my poor dear Uncle James, such an out-of-the-common person he was, Ruth, and such a beautiful talker, and it was not till 6 months later, niece's mourning, you know, that I had the dress on again, and a business I had to meet it, for all my gowns seem to shrink when they are put by, and I put my hand in the pocket and—" But Ruth had disappeared. Mrs. Alwyn was perfectly certain at last that something must be wrong with her niece. Earlier in the day she had had a headache. Reasoning by analogy, she decided that Ruth must have eaten something at Mrs. Thursby's dinner-party which had disagreed with her. If anyone was ill, she always attributed it to indigestion. If Mr. Alwyn coughed,
or if she read in the papers that royalty had been unavoidably prevented attending some function at which its presence had been expected, she instantly put down both mishaps to the same cause, and when Mrs. Albin had come to a conclusion, it was not her habit to keep it to herself. She told Lady Mary the exact state in which, reasoning always by analogy, she knew Ruth's health must be, when that lady drove over that afternoon in the hope of seeing Ruth, partly from curiosity, or rather a Christian anxiety respecting the welfare of others, and partly, too, from a real feeling of affection for Ruth herself. Mrs. Alwyn bored her intensely, but she sat on and on in the hope of Ruth's return, who had gone out, Mrs. Alwyn agreeing with every remark she made, and treating her with that pleased deference of manner which some middle-class people, not otherwise vulgar, invariably drop into in the presence of rank. A cellar which is only one degree better than the Charybdis of would-be ease of manner into which others fall. If ever the enormous advantages of noble birth and ancient family, with all their attendant heirlooms and hereditary instincts of refinement, chivalrous feeling, and honour, become in future years a mark for scorn, as already they are a mark for the envy that calls itself scorn, it will be partly the fault of the vulgar adoration of the middle classes. Mrs. Alwyn being, as may possibly have already transpired in the course of this narrative, a middle-class woman herself, stuck to the hereditary instincts of her class with a vengeance, and when Ruth at last came in, Lady Mary was thankful. Her cold, pale eyes lighted up a little as she greeted Ruth and looked searchingly at her. She saw by the colourless lips and nervous contraction of the forehead, and by the bright, restless fever of the eyes that had formerly been as calm and clear, that something was amiss. Terribly amiss.
"I've been telling Lady Mary how poorly you've been, Ruth, ever since Mrs. Thursby's dinner party," said Mrs. Alwyn, by way of opening the conversation. But in spite of so auspicious a beginning, the conversation flagged. Lady Mary made a few conventional remarks to Ruth, which she answered, and Mrs. Alwyn also. But there was a constraint which every moment threatened a silence. Lady Mary proceeded to comment on the poaching affray of the previous night, and the arrest of a man who had been seriously injured. But at her mention of the subject, Ruth became so silent, and Mrs. Alwyn so voluble, that she felt it was useless to stay any longer, and had to take her leave without a word with Ruth. "Something is wrong with that girl," she said to herself, as she drove back to Atherston. "I know what it is. Charles has been behaving in his usual manner, and as there is no one else to point out to him how infamous such conduct is, I shall have to do it myself. Shameful! That charming, interesting girl! And yet, there was a look in her face more like some great anxiety than disappointment. If she'd had a disappointment, I do not think she would have let anyone see it. Those Dancourts are all too proud to show their feelings, though they've got them, too, somewhere. Perhaps on the whole, considering how excessively disagreeable and scriptural Charles can be, and what unexpected turns he can give to things, I'd better say nothing to him at present." The moment Lady Mary had left the house, Ruth hurried to her uncle's study. He was not there. He had not yet come in. She gave a gesture of despair and flung herself down in the old leather chair opposite to his own, on which many a one had sat who had come to him for help or consolation. All the buttons had been gradually worn off that chair by restless or heavy visitors. Some had been lost, but others, the greater part, I am glad to say, Mr. Alwyn had found and had deposited in a silver cup on the mantelpiece, till the wet afternoon should come when he and his long packing-needle should restore them to their home. The room was very quiet. On the mantelpiece the little conscientious silver clock ticked orderly, gently, till Ruth could hear the sound, then hesitated and struck a soft, low tone. She started to her feet and paced up and down, up and down. Would he never come in? She did not go out to look for him for fear of missing him. Why did he not come back when she wanted him so terribly? She sat down again. She tried to be patient. It was no good. Would he never come home? She heard a sound, rushed out to meet him in the passage, and pulled him into the study. "Uncle John," she gasped, holding out a letter in her shaking hand. "That man who was taken up last night was Raymond. He is in prison. He is ill. Let us go to him." She exclaimed as best she could that a letter had only just been found, written to her by Raymond in July, warning her he was in the neighbourhood of Arley, near the old nurse's cottage, and that she might see him at any moment, and must have money in readiness.
The instant she had read the letter, she rushed up to Arnie to see her old nurse, and met her coming down in great agitation to tell her that Raymond, whom she had shielded once before under promise of secrecy, had been arrested the night before. In a quarter of an hour, Mr. Alwyn and Ruth were driving swiftly through the dusk in a closed carriage in the direction of Down. On their way, they met a dog-cart driving as quickly in the opposite direction, which grazed their wheel as it passed, and Ruth, looking out, caught a glimpse by the flash of their lamps of Charles's face, with a look upon it so fierce and haggard that she shivered in nameless foreboding of evil, wondering what could have happened to make him look like that. End of chapter 30. Chapter 31 of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Cholmondeley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Chapter 31. It was still early on the following morning that Dare, forgetting, as we have seen, his promise to Charles, arrived at Slumberley Rectory, so early that Mrs. Alwyn was still ordering dinner, or, in other words, was dashing from larder to scullery, from kitchen to dairy, with her usual energy. He was shown into the empty drawing-room, where, after pacing up and down, he was reduced to the society of a photograph album, which, in his present excited condition, could do little to soothe the tumult of his mind. Not that any discredit should be thrown on Mrs. Alwyn's album, a gorgeous concern with the golden Fanny embossed on it, which afforded her infinite satisfaction, inside which her friends' portraits appeared to the greatest advantage, surrounded by birds and nests and blossoms of the most vivid and lifelike colouring. Mr. Alwyn was encompassed on every side by kingfishers and elaborate bone nests, while Ruth's clear-cut face looked out from among long-tailed tomtits, arranged one on each side of a nest crowded with eggs, on which a strong light had been thrown. Dare was still looking at Ruth's photograph when Mr. Alwyn came in.
Do you wish to speak to Ruth?" he asked gravely.
"Now, at once." Dare was surprised that Mr. Alwyn, with whom he had been so open, should be so cold and unsympathetic in manner. The alteration and alienation of friends is certainly one of the saddest and most inexplicable experiences of this vale of tears. "You will find her in the study," continued Mr. Alwyn. "She is expecting you. I have told her nothing, according to your wish. I hope you will explain everything to her in full, that he will keep nothing back."
"I will explain," said Dare, and he went, trembling with excitement, into the study. Fired by Charles's example, he had made a sublime resolve as he skimmed across the fields, made it in a hurry, in a moment of ecstasy, as all his resolutions were made. He felt he never acted such a noble part before. He only feared the agitation of the moment might prevent him doing himself justice.
Ruth rose as he came in, but did not speak. A swift spasm passed over her face, leaving it very stern, very fixed, as he had never seen it, as he had never thought of seeing it. An overwhelming suspense burned in the dark, lustreless eyes which met his own. He felt awed.
"Well," she said, pressing her hands together and speaking in a low voice.
"Ruth," said Dare solemnly, laying his outspread hand upon his breast and then extending it in the air, "I am free." Ruth's eyes watched him like one in torture.
"How?" she said, speaking with difficulty. "You said you were free before."
"Ah," replied Dare, raising his forefinger, "I said so, but it was an error. I go to Vanden, and she will not go away. I go to London to my lawyer, and he says she is my wife."
"You told me she was not."
"It was an error," repeated Dare. "I had formerly been a husband to her, but we had been divorced. It was finished, wound up, and I thought she was no more my wife. There is in the English law something extraordinary which I do not comprehend, which makes an American divorce to remain a marriage in England."
"Go on," said Ruth, shading her eyes with her hand.
"I come back to Vanden," continued Dare, in a suppressed voice. "I come back overwhelmed, broken down, crushed under feet, and then—" He was becoming dramatic. He felt the fire kindling. "I meet a friend, a noble heart. I confide in him. I tell all to Sir Charles Danvers."
Ruth's hand was trembling.
"And last night he finds out by chance that she was not a true widow when I marry her, that her first husband was yet alive, that I am free. This morning he tells me all, and I am here."
Ruth pressed her hands before her face and fairly burst into tears.
He looked at her in astonishment. He was surprised that she had any feelings.
never having shown them to the public in general, like himself, he'd supposed she was entirely devoid of them. She now appeared quite émue. She was sobbing passionately. Tears came into his own eyes as he watched her, and then a light dawned upon him for the second time that day. Those tears were not for him. He folded his arms and waited. How suggestive in itself is a noble attitude! After a few minutes, Ruth overcame her tears with a great effort, and, raising her head, looked at him as if she expected him to speak. The suspense was gone out of her dimmed eyes. The tension of her face was relaxed. "I am free," repeated Dare, "and I have your promise that if I am free, you will still marry me." Ruth looked up with a pained but resolute expression, and she would have spoken if he had not stopped her by a gesture. "I have your promise," he repeated. "I tell my friend Sir Charles Danvers. I have it. He also loves. He does not tell me so. He's not open with me, as I am with him. But I see his heart. And yet, figure to yourself, he has but to keep silence, and I must go away. I must give up all. I am still married. Whew! While he... But he is noble. He is sublime. He sacrifices love on the altar of honour, of truth. He tells all to me, his rival. He shows me I am free. He thinks I do not know his heart. But it is not only he who can be noble." Dare smote himself upon his breast. "I also can lay my heart upon the altar. Ruth," with great solemnity, "do you love him even as he loves you?" There was a moment's pause. "I do," she said firmly, "with my whole heart." "I knew it. I divined it. I sacrifice myself. I give you back your promise. I say farewell and voyage in the distance. I return no more to Vanden. There is no longer a home for me in England. I leave only behind with you the poor heart you have possessed so long." Dare was so much affected by the beauty of this last sentence that he could say no more. But even at that moment, as he glanced at Ruth to see what effect his eloquence had upon her, she looked so pallid and thin, her beauty was so entirely eclipsed, that the sacrifice did not seem quite so overwhelming after all. She struggled to speak, but words failed her. He took her hands and kissed them, pressed them to his heart. It was a pity there was no one there to see. Endeavoured to say something more, and then rushed out of the room. She stood like one stunned after he had left her. She saw him a moment later cross the garden and flee away across the fields. She knew she had seen that grey figure and jaunty grey hat for the last time, but she hardly thought of him. She felt she might be sorry for him presently, but not now. The suspense was over. The sense of relief was too overwhelming to admit of any other feeling at first. She dropped on her knees beside the writing-table and locked her hands together. "He told," she whispered to herself. "Thank God! Thank God!" Two happy tears dropped onto Mr. Albin's old leather blotting-book, that worn cradle of so many sermons. Was this the same world? Was this the same sun which was shining in upon her? What new songs were the birds practising outside? A strange, wonderful joy seemed to pervade the very air she breathed, to flood her inmost soul. She had faced her troubles fairly well, but at this new, great happiness she did not dare to look, and with a sudden involuntary gesture she hid her face in her hands. It would be rash to speculate too deeply on the nature of Dare's reflections as he hurried back to Atherston, but perhaps, under the very real pang of parting with Ruth, he was sustained by a sense of the magnanimity of what, had he put it into words, he would have called his attitude, and possibly also by a lurking conviction which had assisted his determination to resign her that life at Vanden, after the episode of the American wife's arrival, would be a social impossibility, especially to one anxious and suited to shine on society. Be that how it may, whatever had happened to influence him most of the chance emotion of that moment, it would be tolerably certain that in a few hours he would be sorry for what he had done. He was still, however, in a state of mental exaltation when he reached Atherston, and began fumbling nervously with the garden gate. Charles, who had been stalking up and down the bowling green, went slowly towards him. "What on earth do you mean by going off in that way?" he asked coldly. "Ah," said Dare, perceiving him. "And is she gone?" "Yes, half an hour ago. Your dog-cart has come back from taking her to the station, and is here now."
Dare nodded his head several times and stood looking at him. "I have been to Slumberley," he said. "Yes, contrary to agreement." "My friend," Dare said, seizing the friend's limp, unresponsive hand and pressing it, "I know now why you keep silence last night. I reason with myself. I see you love her. Do not turn away. I have seen her. I have given her back her promise. I give her up to you whom she loves. And now I go away, not to return." And then, in the full view of the Atherston windows, of the butler, and of the dog-cart at the front door, Dare embraced him, kissing the blushing and disconcerting Charles on both cheeks. Then in a moment, before the latter had recovered his self-possession, Dare had darted to the dog-cart and was driving away. Charles looked after him in mixed annoyance and astonishment, until he noticed the butler's eyes upon him, when he hastily retreated, with a heightened complexion, to the shrubberies. End of chapter 31. Conclusion of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Simon Evers. Conclusion. It was the last day of October, about a week after a certain very quiet little funeral had taken place in the Down Cemetery. The death of Raymond Daincourt had appeared in the papers a day or two afterwards, without mention of date or place, and it was generally supposed that it had taken place some considerable time previously, without the knowledge of his friends. Charles had been sitting for a long time with Mr. Alwyn, and after he left the rectory he took the path over the fields in the direction of the Slumberley Woods. The low sun was shining redly through a golden haze, was sending long, burning shafts across the glade where Charles was pacing. He sat down at last upon a fallen tree to wait for one who should presently come by that way. It was a still, clear afternoon, with a solemn stillness that speaks of coming change. Winter was at hand, and the woods were transfigured with a passing glory, like the faces of those who depart in peace when death draws nigh. Far and wide in the forest the bracken was all aflame, aflame beneath the glowing trees. The great beeches had turned to bronze and ruddy gold, and had strewed the path with carpets glorious and rare, which the first wind would sweep away. Upon the limes the amber leaves still hung, faint yet loath to go, but the horse-chestnut had already dropped its garment of green and yellow at its feet. A young robin was singing at intervals in the silence, telling how the secrets of the nests had been laid bare, singing a requiem on the dying leaves and the widow branches, a song new to him, but with the old plaintive rapture in it that his fathers had been taught before him since the world began. She came towards him down the yellowed glade through the sunshine and the shadow, with a spray of bryony in her hand. Neither spoke. She put her hands into the hands that were held out for them, and their eyes met, grave and steadfast, with the light in them of an unalterable love. So long they had looked at each other across a gulf, so long they had stood apart. And now, at last, they were together. He drew her close, and closer yet. They had no words. There was no need of words. And in the silence of the hushed woods, and in the silence of a joy too deep for speech, the robin's song came sweet and sad.
"Charles."
"Ruth." "I should like to tell you something, and I should like to hear it. I know what Raymond told you to conceal. I went to him just after you did. We passed you coming back. He did not know me at first. He thought I was you, and he kept repeating that you must keep your own counsel, and that, unless you showed Mr. Dare's marriage was illegal, he would never find it out. At last, when he suddenly recognised me, he seemed horror-struck, and the doctor came in and sent me away." Charles knew now why Raymond had sent for him the second time. There was a long pause. "Ruth, did you think I should tell?"
"I hoped and prayed you would, but I knew it would be hard, because I do believe you actually thought at the time I should still consider it my duty to marry Mr. Dare. I never should have done such a thing after what had happened. I was just going to tell him so when he began to give me up, and it evidently gave him so much pleasure to renounce me nobly in your favour that I let him have it his own way, as the result was the same. My great dread until he came was that you had not spoken, I've been expecting him all the previous evening.
Oh, Charles, Charles, I waited and watched for his coming as I'd never done before. Your silence was the only thing I feared, because it was the only thing that could have come between us.
God forgive me. I meant at first to say nothing.
Only at first, said Ruth gently, and they walked on in silence.
The sun had set. A slender moon had climbed unnoticed into the southern sky amid the shafts of paling fire which stretched out across the whole heaven from the burning fiery furnace in the west. Across the grey, dim fields, voices were calling the cattle home.
Charles spoke again at last in his usual tone.
You quite understand, Ruth, though I have not mentioned it so far, that you are engaged to marry me?
I do. I will make a note of it if you wish.
It is unnecessary. I shall be happy when I have leisure to remind you myself. Indeed, I may say I shall make a point of doing so. There does not happen to be anyone else whom you feel it would be your duty to marry?
I can't think of anyone at the moment. Charles, you never could have believed I would marry him, after all.
Indeed, I did believe it. Don't I know the stubbornness of your heart?
You see, you are but young, and I make excuses for you. But after you have been the object of my special and judicious training for a few years, I quite hope your judgment may improve considerably.
I trust it will, as I see from your remarks. It will certainly be all we shall have to guide us both.
Postscript. Lady Mary would not allow even Providence any of the credit of Charles's engagement. She claimed the whole herself. She called Evelyn to witness that from the first it had been her work entirely. She only allowed Charles himself a very secondary part in the great event, to which he was apt to point in later years as the crowning work of a life devoted, under church direction, to the temporal and spiritual welfare of her fellow creatures. And Charles avers that a mention of it in the long list of her virtues will some day adorn the tombstone which is long since ordered to be in readiness. Molly was disconsolate for many days, but work, that panacea of grief, came to the rescue, and it was not long before she was secretly and busily engaged on a large kettle holder, with kettle and motto entwined, for Charles's exclusive use, without which she had been led to understand his establishment would be incomplete. When this work of art was finished, her feelings had become so far modified towards Ruth that she consented to begin another very small and inferior one, merely a kettle on a red ground, for that interloper. But whether it was ever presented is not on record. Vanden is to let. The grass has grown up again through the niches of the stone steps. The place looks wild and deserted. Mr. Alwyn comes sometimes and looks up at its shuttered windows and trailing neglected ivy, but not often, for it gives him a strange pang at the heart. And as he goes home, the people come out of the dilapidated cottages and ask wistfully when the new squire is coming back. But Mr. Alwyn does not know. End of the conclusion. End of Sir Charles Danvers by Mary Chumley.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.